Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 303 for September 25 of 2015, Volkswagen's Emissions Nightmare. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary Vasilash.
So the last time I saw you was on a plane coming back from Frankfurt last week.
From the Frankfurt show last week. I know, yeah. And we hate to starve everybody of Auto Line After Hours, but because we were on the plane, we couldn't do the show last week.
Right. That's right.
So we got a great show today, and we should let everybody know. We got Henry Payne from the Detroit News with us right now, the auto critic.
Hi, John. Nice to have you.
Good to have you. You've been doing a lot of criticizing lately, or critiquing?
Yeah, a lot of critiquing.
Okay.
There's a lot of critiquing to be done.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of good product out there.
People love to read about that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
And we got to tell everybody, right now we've got Brian Bouch, the principal engineer for safety for R&D with Honda Americas.
Yes,
I think I got that right.
That's right,
Brian?
Yes, thanks, John.
So, and you brought this cutaway of the new Honda Pilot with you here. Cutaway to show all the different safety things that you put on this thing.
That's right. That's right. We basically took the 2016 Pilot and skinned it about 40% on the passenger side. And we did that for a couple of reasons. One, we wanted to highlight the different body components, including the ACE body structure, which is the advanced compatibility engineering front crash structure that we've implemented on our
and
midsize.
ACE is the Honda sort of trademark.
That's
name
right.
For that,
that's
right?
Right. It's for compatibility. We've been doing it for years. This is the new global midsize light truck platform. So we've incorporated that on the new Pilot. What you can see also is the different colors, and we've done that to highlight the different materials that we used to be able to absorb the energy in any crash scenario, but then also the different colors of steel, so the different grades of material, the different strength to be able to react against any forces that might be applied in a front or a side collision.
Brian, before we get away from it, so the ACE body structure,
yeah,
which Honda uses throughout its vehicles. So when you say compatibility, explain what you mean by that.
So what we've done is we've one of the different phenomenon or the different structures, the elephant nose. So we're able to absorb in this case, a moderate or a small overlap condition. But we've also kept the main frame rails, which absorb most of the energy. The reason for the ACE body structure is any type of real-world collision to be able to help mitigate either underride or override of a smaller or larger car and to be able to absorb those energy away from the occupant and get it out of the occupant's cabin. Now, this works in concert with our platform, so our low-distributing floor, what we've coined the term as a three-bone platform, and it basically takes all of the ACE body structure, that energy, and gets it out underneath from where the occupants are sitting, which is our most precious cargo.
So how is the ACE body structure in a Civic or an Accord different than the ACE body structure in this vehicle?
Similar concepts, absolutely similar concepts. Of course, the mass of those vehicles, the energy, right, of that impact is much different. However, the know-how and the knowledge that we've learned on this platform, we've carried it over to our smaller vehicles and our sedans.
You know, it's amazing. How do you figure out exactly where to put these pieces and what grade of steel or whatever material it should be?
Absolutely. So they kind of go hand in hand, right, where the structure of the material and the different grades of material is critical. And a lot of it's some manufacturing, right? We might not be able to stamp an ultra-high-strength part and put it where we want to. What we've done on the ACE body structure in the front is a lot of the deformable members are, in this case, red there on your screen, shows it's a high-strength steel. It's a 590 megapascal part, but it's a little more ductile, and it's definitely repeatable, and it's in the areas that we want to absorb the most energy. When you start getting back into the occupant space, you start to get into the ultra-high-strength steel, and that's the blue door ring around the front door ring to absorb that energy but then not have any bending or kinking, because that's where the occupants are at.
But what I'm getting at, too, is, okay, it's one thing, you smash a vehicle, and then you can say, oh, that broke, we got to strengthen it. But what I'm getting at is you guys can sort of predict where the load forces are going to go and design a structure to divert the forces where you want them to go.
That's right. That's right. And what we know is that there's a given amount of energy, right? We have a velocity at impact and the mass of the vehicle. We have to absorb that amount of energy. We try to utilize as much of the body structure as we can to be able to shift that energy away from the impact. And we've done that actually with our multi-attachment method of our bumper beam. Most conventional bumper beams are attached in two areas on the main frame rails. We've actually added another, we call it a strap, to the outside or the elephant nose to be able to absorb that energy and transfer it to the opposite side of the vehicle, which is really efficient in a crash.
So, Brian, let me ask you, I come from, I do a lot of racing. I've raced for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I've raced aluminum tube frame cars. Most of us in amateur racing these days are racing riveted aluminum monocoque cars. But the professionals have all gone to carbon fiber tubs.
Right.
And at each step, there's more energy absorption. There's better safety. I mean, Honda is heavily into racing. How much do you guys learn from racing programs?
We definitely learn from the technology and the advancement. There's different vehicles that we're developing that we've learned a lot from that. In particular, a lot of the, like we were discussing earlier, is the chassis components and kind of the dissipation of the energy. In this case, we've actually designed the body to absorb the impact of in a small overlap condition of the wheel, but then have that wheel fracture and get out of the way so that the body is always going to be stronger than our chassis components. And part of that is to be able to not have any intrusion into the footwell or the occupant space and where the people are seated for that impact.
So you're saying that if you get into collision, small overlap, the tire goes flying off the car?
Not necessarily flying.
All right.
But we have,
there's a small overlap.
Excuse me. Some of the videos, you can see is that as that impact happens with that rigid barrier. Now, in this case, you've hit 25% of the vehicle's width. At impact, that wheel does translate rearward, but it starts to load up on the lower, in this case, the lower front pillar, that A pillar. And is strong enough to react against that wheel and break it and fracture it so that it doesn't load into the occupant space.
Mm-hmm. You know, sort of to John's question, and you're talking about having the 590 in the front, and then as you get back, I guess it'd be like 900 megapascal or something along those lines.
Yep.
How do you make a determination of, you know, which grade is better where?
Right. So, in this particular vehicle, we've done hundreds and hundreds of simulations, computer simulations. A lot of our development is done in the computer before we actually build one of our early development vehicles. But again, it goes back to the what's the main purpose of that part? You know, in this case, the door ring, we don't want it to deform, so we want it ultra high strength. So we want it to have very, very strong reaction surface and be able to absorb that energy and not bend. But in other areas, we want it to deform because that's where the impact is. We want it to crumple and to bend and deform. So that in those areas, we might put more of a ductile material.
I got to believe the manufacturing guys come to you, the stamping guys. They go, Brian, what are you doing to us here? This has got to make their lives a whole lot more complicated.
It does, but we try to be smart about where we put the things. And we work with those very heavily. We work with our design side. I'm from Test, so we work very closely together in discussing with the factories and our suppliers to make sure that they can stamp the parts and they can weld the parts as designed.
So you mentioned certain pieces crumpling. Explain to us why you want them to crumple. I mean, I think the common consumer might say, gee, I want my car to look just as it looked before the, you know, or after the accident, before
right.
the accident.
The energy absorption is huge, right? Energy management is crash 101. So what we want to do is have a repeatable mode. So in any type of collision, either in the laboratory or in the real world, we want to be able to have a repeatable result and be able to absorb that energy appropriate. So in the areas that we want high deformation, we want to have a lowered ductile material to be able to absorb that energy. So we're smart about where we put the high strength steel, the ultra high strength steel, to manage the load appropriately.
So crumpling is actually a good thing.
Is good.
Yeah. But as you get the government on the one hand forcing higher and higher safety standards. The government is also forcing higher and higher mile per gallon standards,
right,
which often go in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you got to be lightweighting at the same time you're making safer. That's got to be a real challenge.
It's a good challenge. It's a very good challenge. And what we've done is we've utilized other materials than steel. Inside on the instrument panel, what we call the hanger beam is actually magnesium. So it's a much lighter, it's a cast magnesium part to be able to help save weight. We've added in some different glass-filled nylon components, which are structural rigidity components, to help fill the sections of different pillars to be able to absorb the energy. And by doing that, our section of that pillar can be smaller, so it saves weight. It also helps visibility, visibility of different components as well.
But I think, too, when you talked about the ultra-high-strength steel, that enables you not to have to use even more thicker steel or additional brackets or things
That's
like
right.
that.
That's right. So by doing such, we're able to go thickness down on a lot of those components and save weight there.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the problems, it seems that a number of cars have had at least problems from those of us who have to drive them, is that the A-pillars get increasingly large. This doesn't have huge A-pillars.
No, and that was actually one of the initial design concept was increased visibility, say, versus the outgoing model. And by using ultra-high-strength steel in the A-pillar section itself, we're able to go that section to be reduced versus, the 15 model.
Were those big because of roof crush?
It's part of that requirement as well, yeah. And actually, the A-pillar plays a big role in the small overlap condition as well. That's one of our main load paths, is to send it up the A-pillar and then down the side sill. So both of those load paths are important.
See, and that's why I asked the question. That just sort of blows my mind, that you can control these paths.
Yeah, and that's a lot of our computer simulations. We're able to monitor those forces through those different sections and be able to manage and maybe shift where that load goes, according to changing the design or something like that.
Brian, are you involved primarily in structure, or are you involved in some of these other safety system, proactive safety as opposed to passive safety?
Yeah, so of course the new pilot has the Honda Sensing, which is the active safety systems and driver-assisted technologies. And in this case, it has the collision mitigation braking system, or the autonomous braking system, that's also tested at the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety and is part of the Top Safety Pick Plus protocol. This vehicle has those technologies applied to it, all the way from an EX grade all the way up. That's huge from our standpoint, from safety. Part of my main responsibility is the passive safety, the body structure, the airbags, the restraints. But having that coupled in with the active safety system is huge, right? So prior to an impact, if that vehicle detects, another vehicle or an occupant or someone in front of you, it's going to start braking on its own. As I mentioned, energy management is huge. To be able to slow that vehicle down 2 miles an hour, 5 miles an hour, 10 miles an hour before impact is huge from an energy calculation standpoint. Now that body has to do less, and you're less likely to be injured as severe, or the injury mitigation is much, much less.
And talk about that, excuse me, just because this is an important point. It takes even a very little amount of slowing down the vehicle to make a big difference. Explain that.
It's huge, right? The energy calculation, the 1/2 mv squared, right? That velocity term is squared. So if you can slow that guy down just 2 miles an hour, 3 miles an hour, that contribution of the energy at impact is that much less.
See, that blows my mind. Just 2 or 3 miles an hour difference can make a huge difference.
That's absolutely
in the accident.
Absolutely.
I've been in the pilot and done the stop test,
yeah,
which I think is under a certain speed, right?
Yeah, I think we had demoed it at about 20 miles an hour.
Right. So we're 20. I'm just headed at a barrier at 20 miles an hour, and I stop feet in front of the barrier.
Right.
But so then what happens over 20 miles an hour? It's more about this, just trying to reduce the speed.
Absolutely. And it's highly dependent on road conditions and weather and that sort of thing. It's going to notice that vehicle stopping, or someone's pulling out in front of you, and start to react and, brake. And it'll give you a warning to say, hey, please start braking on your own. If you don't start braking on your own, it's going to start braking for you and do its best to try to minimize or not have that collision or that impact.
Has the ability to be able to simulate the crash tests, is that the biggest change you've seen in your career as you've been with Honda?
It really has. The prediction capability is increased tenfold since I've started. Just understanding the different weld qualities and how the welds will fail and the different fracturing of the material and be able to predict that and to know where the different components might tear or break, right? And then designing structures to be able to prevent that. It has come a long way.
So you get involved in the type of welds or the type of fasteners or the type
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of our design is critical for the welding on how different components weld, how many sheets you weld, the sheets that you are welding, what are the material and what are the thicknesses. It's kind of an endless possibility, but we take all that into consideration when we design the safety into that vehicle.
We've got a couple of quick questions here that came in from the audience right now. Unsprung wants to know, does chassis flex have any input in the design?
We don't consider it much because at impact, everything is kind of where it is at impact, right? It happens, the whole event happens within 100, 150 milliseconds. So at impact, and in this case, the small overlap condition, that wheel is basically trapped immediately between the barrier in the vehicle, and so it dissipates and gets out of the way quickly.
Armin wants to know, has Honda put any thought into trying carbon fiber in the crash structure?
We haven't on this vehicle. Most of this is steel and aluminum and magnesium, as I said. I think it has its merits in different manners, maybe in roof panels or something that we need some weight down. But for the pilot itself, we haven't implemented anything like that.
NSX, I would imagine, has a few things.
Potentially.
What do you think of what BMW did with the 7 Series, incorporating carbon fiber parts into a body and white structure? Have you seen that?
I have not. No, I have not. I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. No one's taken that approach before. You know, they've done carbon fiber bodies, you know, the i3, the Alpha, C4, and the like.
Right.
But
yeah.
No, it's all body and white, and pieces of it, instead of being steel, are carbon fiber.
Right. It's, yeah, another manner to save weight,
right.
Which is, you know, as we mentioned earlier, it's critical.
Well, it's expensive, though. And that carbon fiber stuff is expensive.
It's very expensive. That's right.
Yeah, my race car parts are all three times as expensive if I use carbon fiber.
But oh, yeah.
You never break them, though, so it's not. Does the skin have any effect on crash?
It's pretty. It's the most ductile material we have. It really kind of just deforms and gets out of the way, so it really has no effect.
Mm-hmm. Just along for the ride.
It is. It is.
But, Brian, when you know, John asked, he noticed these new approaches like what BMW is doing with the i3, and they're putting a lot of money into these carbon weaves. I mean, is there a structure out there that's inherently better in your mind than the classic unibody structure?
I think with
steel structure,
our steel knowledge and as many bodies and projects and vehicles that we've developed with the steel, we have a really good understanding. We are implementing aluminum a lot, in this case the aluminum bumper beam. And then also the hood for the pilot is all aluminum. So, and we've looked at different things like fenders and that sort of thing. So up to this point, a lot of our body and white have been mainly steel and aluminum.
Okay, we got another question that just came in from, I hope I say this right, Kvilkia is what I guess I would say. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about, you out there that sent in the question. He wants to know, how important is the powertrain mounting, and what are you doing in those areas in terms of energy management?
So in one of our crash conditions, I guess, is a full overlap, and that's the U.S. NCAP frontal crash, which is 35 mile an hour into a rigid wall. We actually designed the chassis system, in this case our front subframe, to actually break and detach and get and drop that engine out of the way. Because, again, we know where the occupants are sitting. We know that between the occupants and the engine is a thin, you know, a piece of sheet metal. So we don't want to have that engine intrude into that occupant space. So we have that. We've tuned the bolts and that attachment method to break, drop, and get out of the way so that that intrusion of the engine is out underneath the vehicle and not into the cabin.
That's you know, again, I'm amazed by that. You tune the bolts to break the right way.
That mounting structure, the body and the bolts to be able to either, you know, break and get out of the way so that intrusion is mitigated.
And to Gary's point, that's got to be possible through simulation.
Absolutely. Hundreds and hundreds maybe sometimes of, in many component tests, right, where we might take the subframe in a lab and just do some static tests on it or something like that to measure the force and the breaking of the bolts and that sort of thing.
is Brian, are mid-engine cars, rear-engine cars inherently safer for that reason? I mean, crazy people like me tend to drive sports cars, so they get in more crashes. But just in terms of the structure, is it inherently better to have the engine behind you?
It has different challenges. Like if it was in a rear of the vehicle, now the high-speed rear crash is a challenge because now you might have all the fuel components in that engine back there. And believe it or not, that impact of the engine itself absorbs energy. So now that if you remove that from the front of the vehicle, you've lost all that energy absorption. So you have to kind of make up that loss of energy with different body structures or different body components. So I guess it just transfers the concern maybe to the mid or the rear of the vehicle for different types of crashes in that case.
If you're in a front-end crash in a front engine car, a rear engine car, which one would you rather be in?
I'd rather be in a Honda.
or you'd rather not be in a crash at all.
I would avoid it altogether.
Yes.
Well, Brian, you gave the right answer there. You'd rather be in a Honda. Hey, thanks for dropping in.
Really
interesting, just amazing looking at this cutaway of the vehicle, what you've done. So
thank you.
Thanks for being on After Hours.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back. We're going to be talking all about this Volkswagen scandal.
What do you make of that? The VW thing.
Crazy.
You already know that you can listen to AutoLine's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from AutoLine's top-notch insider information with AutoLine on the go. Well, we're back, and we should let everybody know that Chubba Chetta, a contributor now to Car and Driver magazine, former editor of it, but still writing for them, and it's great to have you in the studio with us.
Good to be here, John.
So we got to talk about this Volkswagen thing, and I especially would like to pool our collective knowledge here and figure out how the hell this thing started, the steps that they went through, where it's all going to go now. But, Gary, I know you had pulled some interesting stuff, too, about defeat devices.
Well, this is news now, and we're saying, oh, this is so fascinating. This is happening right now, and I happen to find that the EPA actually had a newsletter that goes back to, now I'm not going to find it, which is not a good thing, so as I'm sitting here covering up for myself, somebody else say something.
But it was back in the 90s, right?
Yeah,
that
I want to
first put up.
Yeah, it was, so August 1998, the EPA enforcement alert, headline, Clean Air Act prohibits defeat devices in vehicles, engines, subhead, Honda to spend $267 million, Ford $7.8 million to settle charges. So basically this was going on way back when, and it's not a new phenomenon.
It went back way further than that. Before I joined Car and Driver in 1980, I worked at Advanced Engine Engineering at Ford. So late 70s, the term defeat devices was known then. And, at the time, emission controls had just, they started phasing in earlier in the decade. They were steadily ramping up. And it was very tough for the industry. Emission controls were in their infancy. The technology was not where it was today. It was very difficult to meet the standards. And at the same time, CAFE had been introduced earlier. So you're trying to meet these ramping up emission standards and CAFE emissions. And we knew about defeat devices. It was clear that they were banned then.
And another important point is the industry did not agree with any of these regulations at all.
Well, no, the industry
fought them openly.
Well, it's not only they didn't want the regulations, and in some cases there was concern about whether they were meetable at all. It wasn't a question of can we meet them at a reasonable cost, can we meet them with good fuel economy and power and drivability. It's can we meet them at all? Because at the time they were ramping up steadily every few years. I think we were at something like a 1 gram NOx limitation in the late 70s, and it was going to go to 0.4 NOx in the mid 80s. And 0.4 NOx, people looking at how the hell are we going to do this? It's really hard. And so the whole notion of, you know, I'm sure people thought about various ways of gaming the system. But what VW has done here is like, it's capital sin. I mean, it's the worst thing you could do. There have been other companies that have been punished.
But do we know what they've done?
Well,
I mean, I'm a little confused reading these stories. What exactly happened here? I mean, is a defeat device, is that all a defeat device does, or is there actually...
Well, no, here...
Well, that's what they call it, but go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's called a defeat device. It's not some gizmo.
Right.
It's anything that causes the car in the real world to behave differently than it does on the emission rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, what VW did was they programmed the car so that it could recognize the government emissions test. And when it recognized the government emissions test, it went to a specific engine calibration that allowed it to meet those tests. And when it wasn't on a government emission test, it ran a completely different calibration that produced better drivability, maybe better fuel economy.
Right.
But apparently the
NOx
emissions...
That's the challenge, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the challenge, though? I mean, here you have... We get this so much in government regulations, is you have regulations on the one hand that want better fuel economy. At the same time, they also want lower particulates. And a lot of times, that works against
what the consumer wants.
They have to meet the regulations.
No,
who cares if it doesn't have as peppy a car? I mean, so basically, what they've done is they said, oh, we have this very peppy car, but it isn't peppy if we actually meet the requirements of the government. And so, you know, to the question of what a defeat device is, so in the official EPA letter that was sent to Volkswagen, it says these defeat devices bypass, defeat, or render inoperative element of the vehicle's emission control system that exists to comply with the emission standards.
Exactly.
So to your point, Chubba, you were saying that you guys knew about defeat devices.
Sure.
From the very beginning.
Oh, yeah. Well, and even then, as primitive as computers were, these emission tests, you know, I think VW, I don't know how they recognize them, but there's a number of ways you could do it. The basic emissions test starts off, you start the engine, there's a 10 or 15 second idle, and then there's an acceleration ramp, which is very clearly defined. So basically, you could tell the car that whenever you recognize that after a startup, you idle for 15 seconds and accelerate along this particular ramp, you're on the EPA emissions test.
One of the other things that came out, too, is look and see if the steering wheel moves.
Right.
Sure.
Or the car goes,
hey, the steering wheel's not moving and we're driving along. Must be an EPA
lab. Or the pedals are not moving.
But that's something even
no,
cruder.
No, the pedals do move because it's literally a human being in the car.
Yes.
So it's just on a dyno?
No, it's not a dyno, but
it's human driven.
Right. So a driver gets in the car, they pull up a video screen, used to be CRTs, and when you push on the accelerator, a little cursor moves on the screen, and there's sort of a jagged line.
Well, there's a trace you're supposed to follow, and it's all clearly defined that, X seconds into the test, the car is supposed to be at X speed, and there's a curve, and there's limits on how far you can deviate, because, you know, nobody does it perfectly, but I think you've got plus or minus half a mile an hour or 1 mile per hour. There's some spec on... if you're a half mile per hour off, how many seconds you can be. I mean, it's all defined. But the point is, there is a human driving it. It's not a robot driving. The other thing they could look at, and of course, modern cars all have wheel sensors for ABS, is that the driving wheels are turning and the rear wheels aren't. And in fact, some cars, you have to purposely put it into a mode to solve this problem, because in many cases, you think the traction control is going to think, well, I'm on wheel spin because I've got the front wheel spinning. So you might have to put it into a dyno test mode, but that doesn't mean you're supposed to disable the emission controls or run a different calibration on spark and fuel and everything else. And that's apparently what they've done.
The other thing, too, that they had to go to was four wheel rolls when they got into testing hybrids. Because when it was only the drive wheels, all the regenerative braking was being captured, which doesn't happen in the real world, and they were overstating the fuel economy benefits of the hybrids.
Sure.
So I know that's one thing they had to do. And to the EPA's credit, over the years, they've added what they call adjustments to the federal test procedure to say, look, cars have more power now, people are driving differently, they're running air conditioning more, blah, 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 blah. So we keep having to make adjustments. And I believe that if you look at the combined EPA number, not the highway, not the city, just the combined number, my bet is 90% of new car buyers will be within a mile or two per gallon of that number. If you live in the mountains, no. If you live in very hilly areas, no. but the vast majority of people will get very close to the combined.
Well, I keep a spreadsheet on my fuel economy for every test car I have. And, of course, you know, one of the downsides of doing that is every test car doesn't get exactly the same driving. Some get a little more highway, whatever. But I kind of look at that, and most cars these days are reasonably close to the combined number. Some hybrids aren't that close. Some of the downsized turbos suffer a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, others actually do better. It's the current number
especially
is pretty good.
Especially diesel Volkswagens.
Well, but back
the
to
the turbos are a real test. I mean, there's so many turbos coming in, and you know, that's a different animal.
Yeah. But back to this story, you know, all along the philosophy was that, you know, even if you're driving at a speed and at an acceleration point that's not on the EPA emission cycle, you are supposed to be using the same type of calibration philosophy. But what the VW guys did, as I understand it, is if you were running down the road at 35 miles per hour, it was running one calibration. And if you were running on the emissions roll at 35 miles per hour and it recognized it was on the emissions roll, it was a completely different calibration. Okay, it was just flat out cheating.
Right. So, to John's earlier point about product development, okay. So how does an engine get developed not meeting the test specifications yet go into production? Okay, think about that. You're developing an engine and you run it on the and you go, "Oh my God, this is 40 times the NOx," right? I mean, it's enormous.
Big number.
Let's go back to I figured that this cheating scheme started circa 2006. And the reason I say that is the recalled models start with the 2009 model year, which really means around September of 2008. And Chubby, you'd know, having been in car companies, I got to believe you got to have this cheating scheme nailed down at least a year ahead of that.
Well, it might even be further than that because it has to do with NOx. And most diesels have the urea NOx catalyst, which is an expensive piece of hardware. It adds weight, it adds bulk, it's
cost.
It's one more thing that the customer has to fill up and, you know, keep this urea tank full. Not that it's, you know, that onerous, but nonetheless, it's one more thing. So, and most diesels have this urea NOx catalyst. VW, I think, thought they could get away without it. Now, they have a smaller car, a smaller engine, so their overall NOx production is going to be less than, say, in a BMW X5, you know, which is a much bigger vehicle. But I suspect they were probably close to the cusp. Mm-hmm. But somewhere in the development process, and it wasn't 3 months before they went into production, they had to make a decision on, are we going to put the urea NOx catalyst in here or aren't we? In fact, you know, keep in mind that on these emission tests, there's sort of a precursor to all of this. You have to do this long-term durability test. And I'm forgetting now, in the old days, emissions had to be had to stay within the limits for 50,000 miles and maybe up to 100,000 miles.
Today it's 100.
It might be 125 even.
Yeah, it's over. It's at least 100, and I want to say 10 or 15 years.
But here's the way you do that. You identify an engine family, and there's regulations for what makes an engine family. And then you run those cars for this 125,000 miles. You measure their emissions every 5,000 miles, I think it is. And then you look at the emissions at the end of the test versus the beginning of the test. Now, you know, catalysts deteriorate with time, and they're not quite as effective at the end as they are at the beginning. Everyone gets that. And so let's say the catalyst has deteriorated by 50%, so the emissions have doubled over the course of the test. That means that when you're calibrating the new car, if the limit is 0.04 NOx, you actually must make 0.02 in your initial test because the assumption is they're going to double over life. Well, doing the 125,000 mile durability test takes time. And you have to have the answer to what your deterioration factor is going to be. And can I make it without a urea cat? Can't I?
Yeah.
You know, that's not done 3 months before production. This is years before production.
And I think there's a larger picture here, which are these government regulations that these companies have to meet. So here's a European company coming over to the United States. They have a technology that's worked in Europe. The TDI, it's a dominant technology in Europe. You come over here, and all of a sudden, the regulation is that much stricter. I mean, we're talking, you know, we hear in the press that it's 40 times as bad. I mean, the NOx regulations in this country are absurdly low. You talk to scientists and they say they're way lower than any detectable health hazard. So as a regulator, you know, what's your window? And what's allowable. So here comes VW. They want to have a major impact in this market in terms of TDI. They think they can do it without urea. Do they think they can play within a window that you're talking about so they can make cars without urea? And then the EPA comes down with a hard number. I mean, it strikes me as very, to Gary's point.
On the fact that these are inconsequential numbers. I don't think that. These are pretty much scientifically based, and there's no question that NOx leads to smog and smog leads to respiratory problems.
Right, but you
can, I can tell you, I'm a mountain biker. I don't go out on high ozone days. I can't breathe.
Right.
I literally can't.
But if you talk to the scientists who look at these things, I mean, what is NOx in China, for example, right now in Beijing? We've regulated well below that. So I mean,
but the rules are the rules.
I know, but you're right about that. You're right about they cheat. I'm just saying, looking at the bigger picture, are the regulators giving these manufacturers enough room? Because there are a lot of technologies out there that can solve these problems, and diesel is one. Diesel is very good on fuel efficiency, not so good on particulates. You know, is the government giving these technologies enough room?
Honda also tried to do a non-SCR diesel. I want to say in circa 2006, 7, 8, somewhere in that time, same time frame that Volkswagen did. Honda announced, we're coming out with a diesel in the American market. No selective catalyst reduction, no urea.
Yes.
Couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. Mazda announced 2 years ago, we're bringing a diesel to the American market. Still haven't done it. They can't do it.
So here are companies that are at least honest
enough to go, hey, we can't meet these standards.
But that's my point. So here are these companies that are working on this, right? I mean, here you have a federal government that wants 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. Here are these companies working on technologies. They can't bring the technology into market because it doesn't meet another government standard. So is sort of the government regulations reasonable? You know, what goals are we trying to do with the diesel?
But they went with SCR.
Yeah, a lot of people are buying that.
Okay, let's explain what SCR is. Okay, because people are not so basically we're talking about the nitrous oxides that are being emitted. There's a lot of crap that comes out of the tailpipe. That's one of them.
It's oxides of nitrogen.
Okay,
nitrous oxide is something quite different.
You want that in the engine?
All right. So you squirt this stuff in, right, and it breaks down that to basically you get water and some nitrogen.
Yeah,
and
it breaks it up.
Right, and then it doesn't come out in...
And here's the problem. Gasoline cars have what's called a three-way catalyst, and it's called a three-way catalyst because as long as you run the stoichiometric air-fuel ratio, it gets rid of the unburned hydrocarbons, the carbon monoxide, and the oxides of nitrogen, all three simultaneously. Diesels can't run stoichiometric. They run lean. That's part of where their efficiency comes from. So they have a regular catalyst, and it does very well on the unburned hydrocarbons in the CO because that works on a lean mixture. But the regular catalyst does not work when it's running lean on NOx. It's as simple as that. And the SCR type of catalyst, which has this urea sprayed into it, does work. But, you know, it's a whole separate catalyst now. It's this whole separate spring. You know, it's a whole bunch of extra cost and everything.
And this is something that is proven technology that's being used on
every other diesel.
Yeah.
Variety of
sure.
And the other thing we should point out is the cost is substantial. We're talking $2,000 to $3,000 per car.
Yeah, I don't know what the number is, but it's big. I would simply, for your urea, on the regulation part, I mean, I don't know if the constant reduction in NOx is scientifically justified or not. I mean, there's never been a government regulator who said the problem is solved. Let's close our doors and cut the budget to our agency. You know, this simply doesn't happen. But at the same time, the rules are the rules. And, you know, you got to follow the rules. And by the way, these current rules that VW ran afoul of, I think they came in with the Tier 2 emission regulations, which started phasing in the 2004 model year. So this isn't anything new. And all along, it has been stricter than Europe because, I mean, Euro 4 was way more tolerant of NOx and other things than the U.S. standard. I think Euro 5 was even looser. Euro 6 might be close to where the U.S.
Because the Europeans were prioritizing fuel economy. I mean, now the Europeans have... You know, the Greens over there have decided they don't like diesels either. But there was a time when they're prioritizing something.
Yeah.
They're prioritizing fuel efficiency. And so that affected our other regulations. It seems in this country right now, they're trying to prioritize everything. And I wonder, you know, not every regulation, you got to obey the law. but bad laws encourage scoff laws. Example, the 55 mile per gallon speed limit. So
per mile, hour.
But to John's point, I mean, that the Chevy Cruze diesel, so far as we know, is meeting the regulation.
And nobody buys it.
We're talking about 5 years of sales of these vehicles and 500,000 units. Okay, Ford sells more F-150s in a year than that. So I mean, nobody's buying these things either.
Well, this is a major strategy for VW as opposed to Chevy. Right. Chevy, that's just a compliance vehicle. This is the heart of VW's market. And what's going to be interesting to me in this investigation, if it does uncover defeat devices from other manufacturers. I mean, the regulators are already looking at Audi and Porsche now. And does this, in the long term, kill
Audi's
diesel?
Audi's included. A3.
Yeah.
Kill diesel in this market.
I'm sure people are looking at other engines. Also, you know, keep in mind that, you know, you can put a defeat device on a gasoline engine, too. There's maybe less reason to do so because, the emission control technology is pretty well understood at this point, but I think there's going to be a lot of investigation here. But, you know, everything that you've said, and I have some sympathy with the point of view that there's conflicting demands from the government, but, you know, that's what the government does. I mean, the guys in Congress and any agency, they can flap their jaws. They don't have to build the cars. They don't have to sell them. They can do what they want. But nonetheless, the law is the law. We got to follow it.
And, absolutely.
And everyone else seems to be following it.
But, Trev, I'm concerned as a consumer. I like TDIs.
Yeah.
I like the technology. I like that I get efficiency. You know, my family's had a couple Jettas. I like the efficiencies. I like the power. You know, with scandals like this, you might just defeat a technology
But some are suggesting that the reason why they did this was that if it met the regulation, it wouldn't be as much fun to drive. You wouldn't have as much torque. You wouldn't have as much peppiness. And therefore, if we shut it off, then you get behind the wheel and you say, damn, I really like this diesel. This diesel is a great thing. If you got into it and you were driving like, geez, this thing is like, you know, I got my foot to the floor and I'm not going anywhere, then you might say, I'm not going to get another diesel. I'm going to go buy a Hellcat.
Prius.
I'm going to buy a Hellcat.
right.
But here's the difference is that these days, and this is why the European environmentalists are wrong, at least with U.S. emissions standards, diesels have to meet the same standard as gasoline.
Sure.
They cannot put out more NOx or CO2 or HC, nor more particulates. So I don't know why the European environmentalists are jumping all over the diesel, because right now, today, and with Euro 6, they're as clean as the gasoline engines in Europe.
Although, so there is
but that's only recently.
Very recently.
Because for a long time,
the
European diesels weren't as clean.
Correct.
And in fact, you did see it. I mean, you know, from trucks you saw dirty exhaust, and oddly enough, in Europe, the trucks often exhaust at more or less wheel level. And occasionally you'd be in a city street and a truck would go by you and blow this cloud of black smoke in your face. And, you know, I always used to, whenever I experienced that, think, you know, these Europeans think they're the environmentalists. Give me a break. You know, they're on the wrong end of this part.
Let me ask you this, because you've been to Frankfurt. You guys know the inner workings of this company. I mean, there's this other sort of executive battle that's been going on in VW, and there's been some speculation in our office that PIEC is behind this. That this is PIEC looking.
You guys are not the only ones.
Coming at finding a way back into the company after this boardroom shakeup.
All right.
What's going on inside?
Kelly, you'd know this better than any of us would. Okay, but it just seems to me that powertrain engineers who are working on developing a powertrain engineers that are responsible for programming the ECU, and presumably that's where the defeat device is, software in the ECU, right? That this would be contained within powertrain and not necessarily get elevated to a higher level.
I would think that. But you never know. And also keep in mind that at Volkswagen, you know, the guys running the company aren't marketing weenies or guys who came out of finance. They're typically engineers and would fully understand the details and ramifications of this discussion in a way that a lot of American executives wouldn't. But I would think it would be within powertrain. But I also would say,
when I was working at Ford, I wouldn't have been a brave enough engineer to do this on my own without bringing my boss into the loop and his boss. And I mean, this is, you know, this is fraud.
This is not a few people on the side.
No. And also to the PIEC argument, and I haven't put together the timeline on this, but when you go back and you realize this stuff that was discovered, I think, early in 2014 or something, right, by those that independent test group.
Yeah,
Then CARB was brought into it and EPA was brought into it. And there were discussions back and forth. That stuff all seemed to happen before the winter corn PIEC dispute in a lot of ways. I mean, who knows what sort of bad blood there was there and how long it was simmering. But I think if you look at that timeline, the notion that maybe, you know, PIEC blew the whistle to the EPA on this to get winter corn, I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
The thing was already out there. In fact, I found a paper that came out last year from Europe, Real World Exhaust Emissions from Modern Diesel Cars. And the conclusion of this very lengthy paper was the average on-road emission levels of NOx were estimated at 7 times the certified emission limit for Euro 6 vehicles. There were, however, some remarkable differences among the performance of all vehicles tested, with a few vehicles performing substantially better than the others. This supports the notion that the technology for real-world clean diesels, already exist. So they exist. They're there.
They're real. And this is where
it's out there.
People are getting confused here because the European, the EU test cycle is easy breezy. There, if you look at the numbers that you have to hit in Europe in terms of emissions, they're not that far off the American ones. But the European test is easy. The American test is very difficult, and as I said, the EPA keeps adding adjustments. Let me just finish the thought here. So some people are saying, oh, real world, these cars get much better fuel economy and higher emissions, ergo they're cheating. No, they're just driving like normal people. They're not driving to the test procedure. Anyway, we got a whole lot more to talk about. We got all kinds of things. In fact, I got some stuff about who might have been the real whistleblowers in all this. And we got to take another quick break right here. We're going to give a good shout out to our friends at Jeep for sponsoring this program.
To see in a Jeep Renegade?
Running wild and running free.
Everything.
And I say, hey, living like we're renegades.
An available 2.4-liter multi-air engine that gets up to 31 miles per gallon highway. The available one-of-a-kind My Skyroof system. And a cabin that just won one of Ward's 10 best interiors. The all-new Jeep Renegade. Take off and take on anything.
Yeah, we're back. So, where do we want to pick this up?
All right.
Let me just add one thing to your comment about how the American tests are tougher. Not only is the fundamental American emission cycle tougher than the European one, but the EPA has added supplementary cycles because, you know, the basic U.S. emissions test is a cold start. But the cold start is actually room temperature. The car has sat at 70 degrees for 12 hours. There is now a version of that test you have to pass with a 20-degree starting temperature.
Wow.
Now, I think the limits are a little bit loosened, but there was some discussion that 70 degrees isn't much of a cold start. Much of the country has much colder temperatures. So now that's been added to it. There's also the basic emission test is run without air conditioning running. There's a test called, I think, SCO3 now. It's a different cycle with the air conditioning on. You got to pass the test there, too. Then there's the USO6, which is a much higher powered test where the accelerations are much harder. I think maximum speed hits 80 miles per hour or something like that. And there again, you've got to pass the emissions on that one. Now, that one may be a hot start, but the point is there have been additional cycles to try and fill in holes in the original test cycle. And by the way, the current label fuel economy numbers use parts of these other tests in order to make them more realistic. Mm-hmm. They're still not involved in the CAFE measurement because if you added different tests to CAFE, you'd essentially be changing the CAFE requirement. So there's the number that gets used for the CAFE calculation, but the label numbers now incorporate these other tougher tests in order to be more realistic. And I think actually EPA has done a pretty good job of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you still have these NOx limits. have been coming down, mile per gallon figures going up. I mean, engineers say they can always solve a problem, but, I think I don't know that these regulations have a goal.
Well, just one last thing, too. EPA is about to introduce the Tier 3 emission standards, which start phasing in 2017, which bring them lower. Now, I haven't looked at that standard too closely, but I think they're combining HC and NOx with a combined limit for the two of them. So you get a little bit of leeway on which one you can kind of push in different times. But to your point, they're continuing to ratchet down right when the fuel economy is ratcheting up, and it doesn't make life any easier.
I'm interested in your guys' opinion on this. So we've seen scandals that became non-scandals before. Audi instant acceleration wasn't real. The Toyota instant acceleration, the gremlins in the electronics, as the congressman put it, wasn't real. Jeep has fought the rear impact accusations from NHTSA. In this case, it seems like VW has folded its cards very quickly. Winterkorn's stepped down. He's admitted a problem. So have you seen a scandal like this before?
No.
Well,
never.
But see, the difference here is, and this is from the Air Resources Board of California, that during a meeting on September 3rd, 2015, VW admitted to CARB and EPA staff that these vehicles were designed and manufactured with a defeat device designed to bypass, defeat, or render inoperative elements.
So they admitted to cheating.
So it's like those other things. People are like, hey, we didn't do it.
That's right.
And here's a case where basically, in real time, they're like,
well, exactly. And even, I think in the mid 90s, GM got fined by the EPA for something that people have occasionally called a defeat device. But in fact, what they were doing was, I think they were kicking up the idle speed in some cars when you turned on the AC, because otherwise they tended to stall.
And
the EPA said you're increasing CO emissions by doing this. And they probably were. But, that's fundamentally different than what VW did. I mean, I think GM probably thought what they were doing was okay. And even if it wasn't okay, it was a very minor thing in order to keep the car running. And in the end, EPA said, no, you can't do that. You got to find another solution. That's right. Completely different than going out from the get-go.
What I understand about this whole thing is that, okay, VW has known about this for some years. VW has changed that engine over the years. They added SCR to the engine.
Completely redesigned it did that.
For this model year, right? You've got your urea this model
still,
year.
It's still a problem. I mean, so wouldn't a fix be more effective than what they're going through now?
Well, no, because I think the only there is a fix, which is probably going heavy EGR and a number of other things, and now the car drives like crap and the fuel economy drops. Or you can put in SCR. But as Jebba mentioned earlier, that's like building, as Bob Lutz used to say, that's like building a little chemical factory underneath the car.
Right.
This is not something you can easily retrofit. In fact, I'm sure you cannot retrofit it.
I agree. Now, and the other thing that they can probably do to cut NOx is reduce boost pressure. Because, NOx occurs during very high combustion temperatures. NOx is purely related to peak combustion temperature. So you bring that peak combustion temperature down and the NOx formation goes down. And, when you boost an engine, that boosts peak combustion temperature. Cut the boost by 5 PSI and maybe you solve the NOx problem, or maybe you lose, 20% of your power. And that's not very desirable, but that may be part of the solution. And that's certainly relatively easy to do, but it's not desirable.
Mm-hmm. But to Gary's point, there's the VW, as different from these other companies, has admitted guilt. Apparently,
yes.
We still got an investigation to get through, but they seem to be starting in a different place. So now you got all these cars on the road from 2009 to 2015. As a company, is that the first thing you do, is you go recall all those cars and put in the boost?
Well, I mean,
specs?
I think at this point you don't do anything till you get EPA and CARB approval, because nobody's going to take VW's word for this at this point. You propose a solution, you run tests on it to demonstrate how this will solve the problem, and then you present it to EPA and CARB and hope they accept it. And by the way, as I understand it, I think EPA stopped sales of 2016 diesels as well, even though I think they have SCR.
That's right.
Because they basically said, you guys are a bunch of liars, and we don't believe you.
Right. No, that's right. And for the Audi A3 as well. Here's where I think it all started, though. You know, there's this talk that there was this testing going on in Europe, and they were finding this discrepancy between the lab and the road. And then they contacted the University of West Virginia because they knew they had mobile equipment. And it turns out that it was the ICCT that commissioned this study, paid for it. That stands for the, I think it's the International Consortium.
Council for Clean Transportation.
Okay, International Council for Clean Transportation. So who's on the board of directors? Margot Ogay, who used to run the EPA's transportation enforcement. Alan Lloyd, who used to run the California Air Resources Board. And there's somebody, and I don't remember his name right off the top of my head, from Argonne National Laboratory, which is the premier national laboratory for doing automotive research, especially in emissions and fuel economy. They're the ones who underwrote all this. I just got a gut feel, could be totally wrong on this, that especially Margot Ogay, former EPA, and Alan Lloyd, former CARB, are the ones who went, we'll fund that study. That somebody had said something to them, or they had some sneaking suspicion that Honda couldn't do this, Mazda couldn't do this, Volkswagen's doing this, and now they're starting to find big discrepancies, not just minor discrepancies between on the road and in the lab. My suspicion is it was the ICCT that first said, you know, we got to get somebody to look into this.
Well, and it would be an irony if that's true, because Ogay is a fuel efficiency zealot.
Yes.
And was Obama's point person on getting this 54.5 by 2025 in place. So does she set up a scenario where diesel, which was one of the major technologies to meet that goal, goes away?
Okay, but Henry, I think that what you fail to take into account is that she probably doesn't care about fun to drive, right? That's probably not among her things. So, yeah. so if she wants, you know, high fuel efficiency and it comes at the cost of low performance, do you really think she's going to stay up late at night and say, "Oh my God"?
Well, and the other piece of that, Gary, is that she's a big electric car advocate. She wants all gas, all carbon engines to go away. Mm-hmm. She wants an electric future.
But isn't ultimately she's actually been fairly pro diesel? Hmm. I mean,
but keep in mind, all of the environmentalists have multiple agendas, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I mean they want good fuel economy, but they also want clean cars, and you know there are also contradictions there. You know, in many ways, you know, they want us to go away from fossil fuels, but they're against nukes, which are the easiest way to take us away from fossil fuels. Yes. Is, you know, replace coal-fired plants with nuclear plants. Yes. I mean, duh, it's obvious, but that's they're exactly the solution they don't want.
Right. Well, but there's issues with nukes too.
Yeah,
but we're operating from the assumption that, you know, the characteristics, you know, the Farfignugen that we were supposed to get from Volkswagen cars that are part of the diesel, you know, reason for being is maybe not achievable. And maybe that's why.
Well, it's achievable when you have the SCR catalyst.
Right, but I'm just saying that, I mean, achievable from an economic point of view. I mean, because you talk to, like, I mean, I've talked to guys at Ford who basically said, you know, we're not going to put diesels in small passenger cars because it's just not cost effective.
Sure. And that's the difference between VW and BMW, for example, where, you know, the car price is a little bit higher and can absorb the extra cost of the SCR.
Right.
Clearly.
So you can do it if you do that. But if you're saying, you know, I'm going to be the biggest automobile manufacturer in the world, which Volkswagen, you know, recently became, and maybe the way they can do that is to sell all these funded drive diesels, when the other guys are going, damn, we would really like to have these funded drive diesels too, but we can't afford to
provide
them to the audience.
Let me bring up another part of this. There's been we've talked a fair amount here about how the U.S. regulations were much stricter than the European regulations, and so there's kind of motivated them to do this. But apparently they did it in Europe too,
yeah,
with the easier regulations.
Right.
So what's going on there?
I mean,
why would they do that?
I know.
I mean, you know, were they not under the pressure they are in the U.S. with the strict regs?
So why would they do that?
I can't imagine. I mean, at that point, you start thinking are they saving some money? I mean, you know, because on all of these cars, you know, we talk about catalysts, but you know, one of the things the car companies are doing, catalysts are expensive because they have precious metal in them, platinum, palladium, rhodium, and you know, if I can get my car to run with a little bit less precious metal and my catalyst costs $400 instead of $500 or whatever, well, I'm keen on doing that. And that may be one reason they did it. I mean, everyone wants to get precious metal out of the catalyst and save money, and everyone works very hard to do this. And maybe that's one motivation. Maybe they wanted to get more of the fun to drive in there. But, you know, in Europe, the pressure, the problem was so much less. Why did they have to do this? I mean, I'm flabbergasted. I have no answer to that, especially because I think in Europe there's several other car makers making diesels in small cars without the SCR catalyst. Yeah. So if they could do it,
analogy there.
Yeah, if they could do it, what's
right.
the deal?
But I mean,
with
is the question now, can they really do it?
Well,
I mean, are they really doing it?
In fact, and we've got a number of questions, and we got to try to squeeze them in right here at the end of the show. But to your point, Gary, MLFMB says, I'm on the wrong one. AAH guest 485. We'll get to MLF in a minute. Is there a chance that it's impossible to program these cars so that they can pass the tests, just rendering these cars useless? I mean, what if there's not a fix, is what this guy's asking.
Well, the guy from the University of West Virginia suggested that the fix may be not as demanding as people think it might be. And it may be that you have to, as you guys were saying earlier, that you have to detune the car.
Can't have fun anymore.
You can't have fun anymore. It's just no more Farfignugan.
Yeah.
No.
MLFMB.
Castor oil from now on.
Wants to know, is it less expensive to develop emissions mitigation than to pay the fines? And I would say...
These fines are going to be like
massive.
The EPA is going to make an example out of them. I mean, you know, this type of deliberate deception just, you know.
Right.
But you know, it's not just that, though, Chubb. I mean, the Audi lesson from way back with instant acceleration is that the negative publicity destroys you far more than any upfront cost.
Yeah.
A lot of these questions we actually answered in our discussion here. Dave wants to know, did any of VW's competitors know about this? Certainly during benchmarking, they would identify some of these anomalies.
Yeah, but would they do a bag test in order to get emissions?
That's the interesting thing about this. They wouldn't.
Right.
Because if you buy a VW and run it on the standard emission cycle to see what it does...
It's good.
It's fine. That's why, you know, some people have brought up how... This is the problem with self-certification. If the EPA did this instead of the manufacturers, well, it doesn't matter. If you run it on the emissions test, it doesn't matter who runs it. It always comes out clean.
Yeah. Hey, we've got a phone call here. Carmen, let's bring in that first one with the VW owner.
This is regarding to buybacks on the Volkswagen diesel thing. A friend of mine who just recently bought a 2015 Volkswagen diesel, took it back to the dealer. They refunded his money and gave him his trade-in back that he had traded in as they had not sold it yet. So my advice to people who have recently bought a Volkswagen diesel and you're unhappy, I would take it back to your dealer and see what kind of deal you can make on getting your other car back.
Boy, my advice would be that guy ought to go buy a lottery ticket because he's gonna win the Super Bowl.
He's got a good dealer. I'm sure a lot of them are saying we can't do anything right now until the company tells us what they're going to do. And that's what I would do. I would actually hold off. You might be able to get full MSRP for the car.
Sure.
Or if you're really a big fan of TDI diesel VWs, this might be a great time to buy because their values, they're going to depreciate.
Wait, except for one thing, you can't buy them.
You can buy them from a private party.
Private party. But you can't even buy a used one from a dealer.
That's right.
They're illegal to sell.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
But buy a used one from a private seller, and you might get a real deal.
You might be able to
do that.
As
long as you want that on the drive.
And don't perform the emissions fix.
Ever. We're down to the end. Like I said, we've got a lot of questions here. Just sort of skimming through them, it looks to me like most of it was answered in the course of our conversation. But, Chubba, it looks like we've got one specific question just addressed to you that's got nothing to do with this VW discussion. But, Carmen, let's bring that one in now.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan out in Old Japan.
Jonathan.
Loving the show. Question for Chubba Chetta. I'm looking at the October 2015 Car and Driver Giant Slayer magazine. With the Corvette Z06 and McLaren and the Lamborghini, what insights can you guys give to the top five finishes this year? And were you impressed? And with what? Thank you very much.
You mean at the
Lightning Lap? He's talking about Lightning Lap.
Well, unfortunately, I was not at Lightning Lap this year. As you know, I used to run Car and Driver, but I left there at the end of 08, so now I'm just a contributor. And so I wasn't down at Lightning Lap and can't tell you about it.
I can. I broke the story for the news ahead of it going out in Car and Driver, and I spoke to your former colleagues there at length. And what's really fascinating about the Z06, which for those who don't know, the Z06 recorded the fastest time in the Lightning Lap in Car and Driver history. Only the Porsche 918 Hybrid was quicker than the Corvette Z06. 918 Hybrid cost $900,000. The Z06 cost $100,000. So that's real bang for your buck. But what amazed the testers down there, the four testers, was that the McLaren, which was the second fastest car, was quicker. This is a long lap, 4 mile lap at VIR, one of our greatest tracks in this country. The McLaren was quicker on all the straight stuff. The Z06 was quicker in the curvy bits. The downforce on the Z06, which they developed with Pratt and Miller and Four Racing, is better on this front-engine Corvette Z06 than a mid-engine carbon fiber tub McLaren. What are they making these days?
650S.
C650S. I mean, that's extraordinary to me.
Well, keep in mind that the Z06 comes with, I think, three different spoiler packages. There's the base car, there's one upgrade, and then there's a second upgrade. And, yeah. You know, this is true of any spoiler package. The more downforce you have, the more drag you have. I mean, apparently in a Formula One car, when you lift off the accelerator at 200 miles an hour, you decelerate at 1G, which is what most cars do at full ABS. So that's how much drag there is from the car. And the Z06, of course, doesn't have that much downforce, but the downforce hurts you on the straightaways, but it really pays off in the corners. And on a road course, the corner speed is what matters.
Yeah.
The only other thing I would add was I went to a launch of the Z06 at the Spring Mountain course in Nevada earlier this year, and I was just shocked at how easy that car was to drive. I mean, you think of a 650 horsepower Corvette as a fire-breathing monster, and you give it just too much throttle, and you're skittering off into the dust. And, you know, within a few laps, I mean, I'm cutting some seriously fast laps using everything the car has, and it's amazingly good. It's very well done. Mm-hmm.
In the same test this year, the Lightning Lap, the Porsche 911 GT3, which is widely considered by motorheads to be the most capable Porsche ever, was 7 seconds slower than
That's
the Z06. That's a lot of time. 6 seconds slower.
Still a lot.
That's a lot of time.
I mean, 6 tenths would have been noticeable.
Yeah.
And you know, so the Z06. I mean, it destroyed the GT3, which is there's always that great competition.
And it's less expensive than the GT3 as well by a fair chunk.
But then in between the two, you've got McLaren, Lamborghini. And there's one other mid-engine carbon fiber car.
The new Huracan Lamborghini, which also is very fast, 600-some horsepower, and couldn't quite keep up.
No diesels in there. And what impresses me there is that all of us have driven carbon fiber tub cars, most recently the Alfa Romeo 4C. They're wonderful. They're so stiff. They have no body flex. This Corvette Z06 is a 3,400-pound aluminum chassis thing. And so, again, to be quicker in the corners than a McLaren is really an extraordinary job by those engineers.
Right. Hey, look, we're going to have to wrap it up. Before we go, Youngblood, I know you got in a question that had nothing to do with today's discussion. Maybe we'll get that for next week. So don't think that we forgot you. Anyway, Chubba, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Great discussion.
Henry Payne, great having you here.
Thanks, too. John. Always good to be here.
And Gary, let's do it again next week.
Let's do that. And Henry, hang on to that car you got. They're going to take it away from you, and they're going to make it slow.
I'm worried about that.
Okay, hope to see you all next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by the all-new 2015 Jeep Renegade.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week.
There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.